Dave Johnson, Hannah Francis, and Lizard. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Ramlagan, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. I have here with me Street Roots correspondent, Jenny Moore. Hi, Jenny. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So this week's edition of Street Roots is called American Carnage. 1 year into Trump 2.0, Street Roots takes a look at the damage. And in this edition, you have two really potent articles concerning ICE. The first one is called America First. Many American families struggle to survive under the cruel immigration policies imposed by the Trump administration. So in this article, you tell a lot of stories of some of the lives that have been impacted by ICE in the last year. And you're really able to show the human impact of these actions, how people's families and livelihoods are being affected. You think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, definitely. I tried to hone it in as much as I could. It just seems like the pieces kept getting bigger, which is actually why we have two. It started as one piece, and then it was like, okay, there's quite a bit here. And there's actually a third one. For the following issue planned, that a sidebar that didn't get it added. So there will be one more for me in the following issue as well.
Amazing. So could you first tell me about Sarah Matsuzaki and her partner, Aboyami Daramola, who was detained by ICE?
Yes. So this is actually the story that started the whole piece for me. And I guess I'll first of all just say that this is not my normal beat. I don't normally write about policy, let alone immigration policy, so this was my first time, but I had heard about their story through Facebook, actually, through a mutual friend who had posted their story, or their GoFundMe, about what was happening. And so I reached out because I was like, you know, just wanting to kind of put a human face to the stuff that's actually happening. And this happened, her partner, Yomi, she refers to him as Yomi, was taken on in October 26th, which I've actually found was kind of a pretty common day that people were being arrested in Portland. So anyway, I had heard about her story of her being very postpartum, like 3 weeks after having their third child, ICE agents showed up to their house and you know, it happened very fast, as we've learned that it does. He was taken in their front yard in front of her two toddler boys, and didn't give her a ton of information, just said he was taking to the Portland ICE facility, didn't give her a number. There wasn't, you know, she didn't get a ton of information from them. And he was only there for a brief time before being moved. I believe he was moved to Tacoma. I don't need to give the specifics on their case, but some of them are in the piece. And he was basically moved very rapidly and now is in a Texas facility, which, and he's been there since October. He's still there. So that was the story that kind of wanted me to get involved, because I, as someone who also is a mom and has young children, and just knowing how much babies need and how much toddlers need their parents around, and just the care that postpartum moms need, I was very kind of like personally touched by it, just really just concerned about stories like that happening everywhere. But like, and it's like, okay, well, her partner was detained, but that affects an entire family. And this is like a really, you know, it's supposed to be a very tender time. And I just, yeah, the way that this ICE disaster, I'll call it, is affecting families, I think is really, really cruel. So that was kind of my, the way I thought of the piece was more focusing on like the cruelty that is being thrust upon families across the nation, but specifically in the Portland area. And yeah, that was what got me going with the story. And then it kind of expanded to, you know, protest coverage, law enforcement. You know, I had originally this story was going to come out before Christmas, and then it got pushed out because it got so big. And then the day of my new deadline was January 9th, which was like the day after Renee Good was killed. So it changed the, again, I was like, this is a developing situation. And also, what a way to be introduced to writing about immigration at one time. But so yeah, I don't know if that sums up anything of of the question you asked, but.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, thanks for all that. This is a really important story, and I do really appreciate the way that you tell it. And it's definitely very clearly focused around the harm to families and relationships that's being inflicted. You know, you're saying it's like such a huge story and such a huge problem, and it's so expansive, and it goes on and on and on because it's so connected to like all aspects of our community and our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You also talk about some other families that have been affected. And you also talk about how Renee Good was not the first person to be shot or killed by ICE. So can you tell me more about some of the other people that were affected by ICE shootings in the last year?
Yeah. The couple that I mentioned in the piece was, let's see, September, I believe, there was a shooting of someone who was undocumented, a father of two, Silverio Villegas Gonzalez. And it was a very similar situation to actually pretty much almost all of the ICE shootings, where it involves a vehicle and them claiming that they shot in self-defense as people were trying to evade arrest because they're rightfully scared. And it was at the shot was at close range. And then on New Year's Eve, just a little bit before midnight, Keith Porter, in the Los Angeles area, was shot by an off-duty ICE officer who acted as law enforcement when Porter was allegedly firing gunshots into the air in celebration of the holiday. So that was one that did not involve a car, and he was also killed. And that was, again, on New Year's Eve. And then we had, that's what was interesting about the piece, is we were reflecting on a year, but then by the time I was turning in the piece, it had been a new year and there had already been two more shootings in 2 days. So it was Renee Good's shooting, and then the following day, the shooting of a pair of people in Portland, out in East Portland. And I believe there was another one. It's just, it's been very hard to keep up with all of them since the new year, honestly, because of how fast it seems like, it just seems like things are escalating quickly, both in the individual, you know, arrests or detainments, and also just across time and the nation. So,
yeah, absolutely. And you know, during all of this, since you started working on this article in October, Matsuzaki has been without her husband and mm-hmm. like trying to deal with all of this and probably try and get him back and also provide for her family. And on top of all that, she's worried about the health of her husband because he's been saying that the conditions are really not good. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, he has, you know, given... he's been in detention since October 26th, missed his youngest's first Christmas. and she's just, I guess, holding it together on her own. And she does have a GoFundMe that some people have been regularly donating to help her kind of, you know, not get evicted and all that. So, and they do have an immigration lawyer, and they didn't share with me the type of relief that they decided on, but she said that they've decided on something that's what's best for their family. But as far as the conditions and I'm not sure when he'll be released. I don't know that they know that either. But he has said that, you know, the blanket that he has to sleep with is like thinner than a sheet. It's like the food, he said, is so just salty beyond belief and, you know, really just almost inedible. And then they have to pay for snacks basically from commissary if they don't eat the food that's served. Everything costs money there. Every phone call costs money. They don't have any privacy, even in the bathrooms and showers. He's told Matsuzaki that there's no windows, so they don't know what time of day it is. If they didn't have the clock, they wouldn't know what time of day it is. And this is consistent with various other accounts of what detention centers in this country are like. And it truly, it seems like a worse facilities and worse treatment than our regular prisons have. So it is very punitive, and when you look into the experts, immigrant rights coalitions and stuff like that, in Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, you know, they say it is a system that's it's designed to be cruel, and it's designed to make money, and it's designed to be cruel and punitive.
Yeah. There's obviously so much more to say about this article, and I highly recommend checking out this article. But is there anything else that you really want to say about it? I wish we had like an hour to talk about this.
I know. That's the thing is, I guess I would just say like, yes, read the articles, but let it just be like a jumping off point for more research and knowledge. And even if it's not like in your algorithm or on your feed, like try to find like what's actually going on the ground in places like Minnesota right now. And I think while it is like horrifying to like hear the stories and to hear people speak about what they've been through, whether it's protesters facing abuse or, you know, false arrests, citizens being arrested, anyone, immigrant or not, being mistreated, I think one thing giving me hope is that people are not standing for it and that people are organizing and doing a lot of the legwork that people in the system and people who are elected officials are not doing or not pushing for hard enough. So that does give me hope.
And that leads perfectly into your second article, which is titled Push Back. Portland protesters have given us inflatable frogs, naked bike rides, and record-setting streaks of daily marches. Here's what's keeping us hopeful in the face of growing authoritarianism. Such an important article as well. I really appreciate this. And since we don't have a super long time, if you could just like elaborate a little bit more on like a few of the main points that are keeping us hopeful right now.
Yeah, I think, oh, I'm just so grateful to live in Portland. Because it really does, I feel like seeing people fighting back and protesting and boycotting and checking on each other and documenting ICE activity in their neighborhoods and all that stuff. It's basically about that, just on a small level, because I could have probably written like 3 more articles just about this because of how much is happening right now. But yeah, basically it talks about how the frog has become a symbol for protest, not just in Portland, but across the nation, which is from what I gathered in researching this, it's that when a specific frog named Seth Todd got allegedly intentionally tear gassed right into his, what he called his frog hole, his frog vent, an officer gassed him right into his suit, and it became like a rallying moment for everybody. And it, now there's like the Portland Frog Brigade, and like Maxine Dexter is like wearing frog earrings all the time and inviting, you know, all these inflatable frogs and other animals now, because all the frogs sold out, that now there has to be other animals. So it kind of talks about that, and just kind of like how the power of like absurdist humor and creative protest can just kind of like reveal the truth of what's happening on the ground. Obviously, it's not all fun and games, and there's a little talk of that too, but so it's about the frogs, it's about other things giving me hope, younger people getting into the race for different local offices. That gives me a lot of hope, because I think we need a lot of new leadership at every level. I think for a long time, like, my generation has kind of just been like sitting out, like letting these like bureaucrats letting people run the show for a very long time and not letting our voices be heard. And I think it's time for younger people to get in there and start, you know, shaking the table a little bit. So there's talk of that. There's also protests, but also it's like about different people's accounts, making testimony in a Hillsborough City Council meeting. We talked about Manny Chavez, who is the teenager who spoke up and got very emotional and went viral for his really poignant testimony he gave in a Hillsborough City Council meeting. And like, you know, that was not an intentional thing he wanted to gain attention for. He showed up to support a teammate and also speak up for his community, because he is fearful for his family members. So he didn't mean to go viral, but he did. But now he's, you know, launched this other fund where now he's like getting organized and wanting to deliver groceries for people who are afraid to leave, and, you know, started a whole GoFundMe that's, I think, raised like $55,000 now. It's getting pretty close to its goal to provide just a swath of other things for families who have been impacted. So that's another thing that makes me hopeful, is like just seeing the youths just being themselves, like making change and doing good for others. Like, that brings me hope, because I think there's a lot of talk of like, oh, the kids are not all right, and they're, you know, they're just like, you know, spaced out on their devices all the time, they're not paying attention, you know. So kids like Manny are giving me hope too.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, people are on their devices but also plugged in and also trying to make this place better.
Right. The teens are actually doing quite a bit on their devices, quite a bit of organizing on their devices. So
I really appreciate you sharing your time with me and sharing these articles.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Street Roots correspondent Jenny Moore. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Laura Grimes, Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about some of the latest arts news from our region. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Thank you for being here. This first article we're going to talk about is called An Intimate Exhibit at Lewis and Clark College Brings Medieval Manuscripts into the Context of Community by Fran Gardner. Talk to me about this article and this exhibit.
There's an exhibit at Lewis and Clark College called Shaping the Soul, Books in Medieval Life, and it runs through March 6th in the library, the WatchTech Library at the college. And it's a really rare opportunity to be able to see medieval manuscripts. We don't get a chance to do that much here in the Northwest. There are 30 medieval manuscripts from the 13th through the 16th century. And so what's kind of on tap here, they're for instance, a lot of these are items that are from the Lewis and Clark's own collection, and they've never been exhibited before. So this is really a rare chance to see them. So just to provide some context, in the Middle Ages, books were something that people used all the time. They really brought people together. They, brought families, colleagues, religious communities together. People were able to learn from them, but they were also really rare and precious because they took a lot of effort to create at the time. They were all hand done, but they were used all the time, every day. Even these, rare and precious commodities. So, but what was fun about, some of the books that the story talked about, it was fun to see, for instance, there'd be a beautiful book with really carefully done calligraphy, but then there would be in the margin just a sketch of a horse grazing and other little figures jotted. Like it was just an everyday, like a college textbook that somebody has drawn in. So it's kind of fun to see, that these very old sort of artifacts, how people just use them all the time. So before books, there were scrolls that were used. So that these are kind of like the early version of what replaced those. And then in 1452, there was, the famous Gutenberg Bible, and that kind of changed everything to the printing process. So being able to see these other artifacts before the age of printing at these, beautifully handmade done. So what I loved about these is just how gorgeous they are, the illuminated pages with colorful imagery. It's just rare. One thing nice about the story is that Karen Gross, who's a professor of English at the college and helped to make this collection possible, that she has this particular interest in medieval art. And I love the story how way back when she was in college, she studied in Italy, and she went to a church, and she was poor and didn't have any money, but the only other person there were some German tourists, and they put money in a box to be able to have light in one of the chapels so that you could see it. So as a poor student, when those people left, she then went into the chapel in order to be able to take advantage of the free light in there. And she saw a cycle of medieval paintings that were just like really beautiful. And she was transfixed by them, but then there was this click and the chapel went black, but that's all it took. She was really hooked on medieval art. So I thought that was just a sweet little story about this collection of books that people can see now through March 6th at Lewis and Clark WatchTech Library.
Now, the second piece we're going to talk about is called Oregon Carves Its Own Path in 2026's America 250 Anniversary Celebration, by Jim Redden. Well, this anniversary snuck up on me, but that's not the case for many Oregon arts organizations who have a lot planned for this year. What are some of the things coming up in 2026?
I think I was kind of in the same boat with you, Althea. It was about, I will say it was about more than a month ago, earlier in December, I was kind of going, you know, I actually really should have a plan for how we're going to cover the American 250 anniversary this next year in 2026, and what the Oregon celebrations are going to look like. So I actually kind of started digging down and realizing. So I've kind of, we've been coming up with a plan, and I can, you know, kind of give a little bit of outline of what various organizations around the state are planning. I just have a few right now, but this will definitely be a growing collection of celebrations around the state. So there's what's called the America 250 Oregon Commission that has come together. Several people serve on this, and Carrie Timchuk, who's the director of the Oregon Historical Society, chairs this commission. There's a website that you can find, and people are starting to post what events they have coming up. It's still sort of something that's growing, and definitely there's not a lot there right now, but I know that this will be something that continues to have opportunities available. So just to highlight a couple of things that are going on now, for instance, the Oregon Historical Society itself is doing a conversation series called The Right to Be Free. They're covering really interesting topics like incarceration, immigration and deportation, tribal sovereignty and civil rights, race, citizenship, and labor. So they're just having a conversation with very key experts are sort of leading those conversations about what it means for the right to be free. And then the Oregon Historical Society also has a lecture series about lessons of the American Revolution. So they're exploring, you know, they'll have various historians come in and explore that topic. But then, you know, like Oregon Humanities will have a conversation series called Beyond 250, which will be about democracy, freedom, and what it means to be an American, you know, and not just this year, but what that means in the future. How are we going to shape that future? And then the immigrant story, which sheds light on the structural inequalities that continue to impact marginalized communities. They will be exploring various topics of this. And then like Oregon Contemporary Artists Biennial, Oregon Contemporary hosts a biennial every couple of years where they curate a show of artistic works all around the region. And this year they'll be exploring themes of place, power, and promise. So there will be some what are, you know, kind of thought of as traditional patriotic celebrations, but there will also be a lot that explore just a variety of other topics, just, you know, how there are many complexities that have shaped America's history and Oregon's history, and what has been the role of how Oregon has helped shape the country's history. So there are a lot of complexities to it to be explored, you know, Japanese internment and tribal rights, and Black history. There's just so many different communities that have meaningful experiences here in the state. So I think that it will be interesting to explore a lot of these topics, anything from you know, just how people's stories, people's meaningful stories, and so I'm what Oregon Arts Watch is going to focus on this next year is how to bring to life the kind of the untold and forgotten stories throughout the state and documenting some of these events that are happening.
If our listeners want to find out more for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read these stories and so much more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it too.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest arts news from our region. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.